And our guest this hour, Michio Kaku, we're talking about his work, Physics of the Future. We'll take your phone calls and a little bit more questions on Coast to Coast AM. Parallel universes, string theory. How many could be out there, Michio?
Well, we think that there could be 11 dimensions to this great universe of ours. Many people ask the question, if the universe is expanding, then what is it expanding into?
Into, that's right.
It could be expanding into another dimension. So if our universe is a bubble, and we live on the skin of the bubble, we're trapped like flies on flypaper, the bubble is expanding. That's the picture given to us by Einstein. The new wrinkle in all this is we think there are other bubbles out there, other bubbles. Think of a bubble bath. This is called the multiverse. And the multiverse idea has taken the physics community by storm. Conferences now are being held on the multiverse idea. And basically, our universe may not be alone. This is another Copernican revolution, realizing that our solar system may not be alone, our galaxy may not be alone, and now our universe may not be alone, that we could be a three-dimensional bubble floating in 11-dimensional hyperspace.
How did these universes even get created, Michio?
Well, we think that these universes are created when these two bubbles collide, creating a bigger bubble. This is called the Big Splat Theory. Or a bubble fissions and peels off a baby bubble, and that could be the Big Bang. So our universe may have been basically peeled off a much larger parent universe. This is called the inflationary picture. And it fits all the data coming in from satellites fits this basic picture.
But how did the first one start?
Well, we don't know what started the whole multiverse. If you think of each soap bubble having a beginning and an end, then there is a genesis to each soap bubble. Each soap bubble has its own genesis.
Mm-hmm.
But the multiverse itself may have no genesis at all. Now, this combines the Judeo-Christian theory of genesis with the Buddhist theory of nirvana, which is timelessness. So at first you think that the two pictures are totally different. Christian thinking talks about in Genesis, while Buddhism talks about timeless nirvana. But now we can meld these two pictures into a single picture. We now think that there is a nirvana, this empty 11-dimensional hyperspace, but nirvana is unstable. Bubbles form, and these little bubbles expand, and these are Big Bangs. And so Big Bangs take place all the time. Even as we speak, universes are being created.
Okay, let's take some phone calls with Michio Kaku. We'll start it off by going to our first-time caller in Arizona. Ingrid is with us. Hello, Ingrid.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Well, I was just, I don't know if you ever watched the program Fringe, where they have parallel universes. And they said if one of the other worlds combines with here, with this Earth, then the person would die or there'd be some friction. Do you believe there's a possibility that there is another Earth somewhere, identically, exactly like Earth?
Well, there's even a movie playing in the movie theaters about another Earth. We physicists do believe that there are carbon copies of you. That in some universes, there's one thing different. You have a twin brother, a twin sister. All of a sudden, you realize that your neighborhood is totally changed. One quantum event can change that. For example, if a cosmic ray went through Hitler's mother, then perhaps Hitler's mother had a miscarriage, and Hitler was never born. And all of a sudden, 60 million people didn't have to die. And so your head goes spinning. But in the quantum theory, it does open up the possibility of many worlds, that there could be an Earth exactly like our Earth, except with one tiny quantum difference. One cosmic ray going through Churchill's mother, in which case Germany won World War II, and so we're all speaking German now rather than English. So these are things that we physicists have to take very seriously, because that's where the theory is taking us, into a multiverse of universes.
Do you think sometimes, Michio, that these universes cross over? So people who think, for example, they're seeing shadow people, that...
Well, H.G. Wells wrote a very famous short story where you have these parallel planes, and one time these parallel planes intersected, and there was an angel in one universe that then crossed over into our universe, and there was a minister who was shooting quail, and all of a sudden he accidentally shot the angel out of the sky and felt very embarrassed because he shot an angel. It was a short story, but it does give you the possibility that sometimes maybe these universes might intersect. The intersection point is called a wormhole. It's a bridge between two universes. So think of the looking glass of Alice. Alice's looking glass would be a wormhole connecting the countryside of Oxford with this incredible world called Wonderland. And we physicists believe that, yeah, there could be wormholes out there. We think that maybe even the Big Bang, for example, may have expanded a microscopic wormhole. And so there could be even maybe naturally occurring wormholes, gateways between our universe and other universes. Now, so far, to be fair, we've never found one. We've never seen such a wormhole, but it's conceivable. And if you have a black hole, for example, all the matter falls into a black hole, but then the question is, where does all the junk go? Maybe it falls through a wormhole and it is blown out the other end in a white hole. And so perhaps two universes might be connected by something like a black hole, with a black hole on one side eating up stars and galaxies, stars, and the other side of the black hole spewing it out. And some people even think that that could be the Big Bang. I've read one physics paper which said that perhaps the Big Bang is nothing but a white hole connected to a black hole someplace else.
Will we ever get these answers, Michio?
I think so. You see, the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland, will give us the first clues as to what is beyond what is called the Standard Model, and may give us clues as to the validity of string theory. String theory is what I do for a living. That's my day job.
That's right.
What I get paid to do, actually.
And you do it well, by the way.
Oh, thank you. And string theory is the only theory which could actually answer some of these cosmic questions. Can you bend time into a pretzel? Can you go backwards in time and meet your teenage mother before you're born, and then she falls in love with you? And then what do? You're in deep doo-doo when that happens. These are questions that are unanswerable within Einstein's theory, because Einstein didn't go far enough. String theory takes you all the way. It actually has within it the capability of answering these questions. Are there stable wormholes? Is it possible to build gateways to the past? These are questions that cannot be answered within Einstein's theory, but can be answered within string theory. And that's what I think is so exciting, that the Large Hadron Collider may be able to create a new generation of particles called sparticles, superparticles for short, and these sparticles may be higher vibrations of a vibrating rubber band, and that in turn may prove the validity of the theory. This is incredible. A machine which may actually begin to probe the periphery of string theory.
Very possible. Let's go to Gregory, Studio City, California. Hey, Greg, go ahead.
Great show tonight. Okay, I recently visited the touring exhibition called The Human Body, where they had various human bodies in all different states, from complete to just the nerves, to the skeletal, to the muscular structure. It was a touring exhibit, went all around the world. It was absolutely fascinating. And what really surprised me was seeing how complex the human body is. And when they showed some human bodies of all different ages, complete, they would look like the person was almost still alive. And what really shocked me was I didn't understand how was this person alive and their body perfectly in suspended animation now, but now they're not alive. So what is the physicist's explanation as to what is the switch or the mechanism that animates the body and you're alive, and then a moment later, you're not alive, but your body is still there? We call it a soul or a spark of life. But what is that knowledge of self and that ability to animate the body?
Well, you ask a very deep question. Is there a soul, right? You know, some scientists have tried to weigh the soul. They've tried to weigh the human body before death and after death. And some people even claim that they've been able to weigh the soul. It comes out to a few grams, I think I heard last.
Yeah.
Other people say that they see nothing, that the death is basically a continuum. However, if you take a look at the brain is the master switch that controls everything. At one point, we used to think there was a little man up there, a little man with an off-on switch. On meant you're alive and conscious. Off meant you are dead and unconscious. We can't find that man. We have MRI scans now. We've been able to scan huge parts of the inner structure of the human brain, and we find that the brain is basically an organic object. There is no little man there. There is no little switch. And so death and even unconsciousness is much more complicated than we thought. For example, something as simple as anesthetics, when you go into unconsciousness, scientists still don't know how they work. I was rather shocked when I found that out, that the scientists are still puzzling over where is the switch? What is it in gas, in certain gases that make you unconscious? We still have not yet found that little man. And so we think that the brain is much more complicated than we thought. And consciousness and unconsciousness, death and being alive, is much more sophisticated than we originally thought.
Let's go to Josie in Richmond, Virginia, on the Wildcard line. Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Greetings, everybody. I have a burning question, and I'm so glad to be on to ask you, Michio, about this, and that is about thorium as a nuclear power source instead of uranium, when thorium is cheaper, more plentiful, and above all, safer, so that if there's a nuclear accident and we have an earthquake or something, we can walk away from the plant and not worry about a meltdown. We can also call Iran's bluff on all this business with nuclear power, and we can help the world have more safe and running and nuclear energy, which would help all these developing nations. What do you think?
Well, in principle, it might be possible. However, the practical considerations outweigh that. Back in the 1950s, when Admiral Rickover built the Nautilus, and the Nautilus sailed underneath the North Pole, it sent shivers down the spine of utility executives who believed that you could have Nautilus submarine reactors everywhere in your backyard.
Yeah.
That began the light water revolution, which uses uranium power. Since then, we've created this multi-billion dollar fuel cycle based on uranium, and it would be extremely expensive to then revert to a change to a different kind of economy based, let's say, on thorium or something else. It's not that it's not possible. It's just that the dice was thrown back in the 1950s. We had this huge fuel cycle based on mining, milling, enriching fuel, uranium fuel, and then deep-sixing it as nuclear waste. We tried to build Yucca Mountains to handle nuclear waste. This huge, humongous nuclear fuel cycle based on uranium. And so I think it's simply impractical to make a sudden shift at the present time. Now, I think that there's another game changer lurking in the window, in the curtains, and that is fusion power, hot fusion. The French are bidding the store, 10 billion euros, on the ITER fusion reactor to be based in southern France, and they fully expect to have break-even, that is, to have enough energy coming out to energize the whole reactor, and they hope to have it operational in 8 years' time. And so the best bet for a replacement for uranium might be fusion power, which uses seawater as the basic fuel. There is no nuclear fuel cycle for fusion. It just basically uses seawater. The waste product is helium gas, which is actually commercially valuable. Now, to be fair, fusion does not yet exist. It's the power of the sun on the Earth. But at least we physicists think, that it should work on the first try. The mathematics seems to be in place. We think we know enough about hot fusion now to create the first fusion reactor. So if you're going to start up all over again, I think a better bet might be fusion power.
What is it about uranium, Michio, that is so explosive, basically, as opposed to some other element?
Well, when you look at the amount of energy stored in the nucleus of the atom, you find that hydrogen has perhaps the most energy stored, and that is the power of fusion, the power of a hydrogen bomb, the power of the sun. However, on the other side of the periodic chart, you also find that uranium has more energy stored in it per proton, per neutron, than other elements. So if you split the uranium atom, you go to a lower energy state. So uranium is at a higher energy state. If you split it, it goes to a lower energy state, and that's the power of the Hiroshima bomb. That's the power of the atomic bomb. The problem is, when you split the uranium atom, you have all this junk coming out, nuclear waste, enormous quantities of nuclear waste, 30 tons per year of nuclear waste from a conventional nuclear power plant. That's huge, and we don't know what to do with it. We have nuclear constipation right now as all this nuclear waste backs up. We don't know where to put the nuclear waste, and all of it is created by splitting the uranium atom. Now, when you fuse hydrogen, you just get helium, period, end of story, no nuclear waste at all. And so that's why fusion could be the best bet if you want to go nuclear.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Foster City, California. Andy's turn. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Hey, George. How much are you? How are you guys doing?
Great.
Awesome. Yeah, George, we've crossed paths a couple of times. I talked to you on the 40-foot screen when at the Bell Theater.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I asked you a question about
that was
the
fun.
Life of Jesus and stuff. Oh, that was awesome. And actually, I was at Conspiracy Con, too, and I remember the last year the drama kind of unfolded between Lynn Horowitz and the FBI agent. That was kind of weird, but probably was a great event.
Right.
And, Michio, I wanted to talk to you.
Yeah.
What do you think about the ancient alien theory? And what's your take on, like, fringe stuff like 9/11, inside job, and JFK, stuff like that? And, George, I just want to say thank you. And I own a conspiracy T-shirt company, and I'd like to send you and Tom some things. Is it okay if I get your P.O. box on the way out?
Oh, I'll let you talk to Tom. I don't accept the gifts, but he'll tell you about that. Go ahead, Michio.
Okay, well, if you talk about ancient astronauts, realize that when we physicists ask the question, how do you colonize the Milky Way galaxy when there's so many stars, you realize that an advanced alien civilization would probably send a space probe to land on a moon, and it would then create a carbon copy of itself. In fact, thousands of copies of itself, because the moon is stable, there's no erosion, there's no rain, rust. And then these thousands of probes go to other moons, each one creating thousands more. So with one robot, you get 1,000, and then you get 1,000 times 1,000, or 1,000,000, and then the next generation, 1 billion, trillion, quadrillion, and pretty soon you colonize the entire Milky Way galaxy. That means that on our own moon, there could be, quote, an ancient astronaut. There could be a probe left over by a passing advanced civilization that wanted to, you know, scan this sector of the Milky Way galaxy. Now, this is the basis of the movie 2001. 2001 is actually the most credible example of an encounter with an extraterrestrial intelligence, that we may not meet somebody that's made out of flesh and blood and has big eyes and has green skin. We may actually meet a robot probe, an ancient one, perhaps millions of years old, on our moon, left over from a passing, what is called Type 3 civilization, that is colonizing the Milky Way galaxy. Now, Arthur C. Clarke thought that by the year 2001, we'd have the ability to detect such a device. I think more than likely it's going to be 2100. 100 years from now, we'll have
wow.
an operating moon base with the capability of scanning the entire surface of the moon, looking for any anomalies, any energy source that's anomalous on the moon. And then we may be able to detect the fact that, yes, there is an ancient astronaut on our own backyard, on our moon, that's been scanning us and simply waiting. And that is the basis of the movie 2001.
Right.
And when Kubrick did that movie, by the way, he interviewed a lot of scientists and astronomers who laid out this scenario. It was talking heads at the beginning of the film. Then he cut the first 10 minutes of his own film, and the film became semi-mystical. But even today, it is the most realistic example of an encounter with an extraterrestrial civilization.
It goes on forever, and we're coming right back forever with a final set of phone calls with Dr. Michio Kaku on Coast to Coast AM. Well, those of you who are members of the Coast Insiders Club, our video chat tomorrow, 8 p.m. Pacific time. So that is a neat little thing that is part of being a member of the Coast Insiders Club, which you can join for less than 25 cents a day. Simply go to coasttocoastam.com and fill out the information at the top of the homepage that says Coast Insider. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Michio Kaku and final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Michio, we talked a little bit about the coronal mass ejections and the fact that it has always been happening, except that we're so technologically involved now that any big one that hits us could really screw things up. People talk about our power grid not being insulated from these X flares. Is there anything we can do about that?
Oh, sure. There's a lot. First of all, the American Physical Society, which is the largest organization of physicists in the United States, tried to get Congress to allocate peanuts, just a few hundred million, to reinforce our satellites, create redundant systems, reinforce our power stations, and Congress just laughed at us. But we estimate that the property damage from a huge solar flare could be $2 trillion. That's with a T, not with a B, $2 trillion. We're talking about a crippling blackout of not just one city, but perhaps hundreds, thousands of cities around the planet Earth, and wiping out of the GPS system, the internet, weather satellites, as well as endangering the astronauts, as well as knocking out power plants on the planet Earth. It could be food riots within a matter of days as people's refrigerators start to heat up and food begins to rot.
Oh, sure.
And there's no rescue in sight. Law and order could break down as police forces are overwhelmed because all the electricity is out. So just a little bit of money, a few hundred million, would be enough to reinforce our power stations and satellites. But Congress just thought we were nuts, even though we are the largest organization of physicists in the United States.
All right, back to the phones. Lee in Rockville, Maryland, on the Wild Card Line. Lee, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, gentlemen?
Good, Lee. Thank you.
What happens, I was out in Death Valley in the 80s, and it's 36 inches lower. What happens if all that weight falls down in that magma, you know, the volcanic thing? Wouldn't that throw the Earth off balance because it'd be hundreds of trillions of tons of weight hitting that magma underneath? And wouldn't it throw the Earth make a polar shift like in Isaiah 24:1? Or the says Isaiah 13:13 says it might throw the Earth out of its place.
Well, when you take a look at monster cataclysmic events like the Chilean earthquake or the Fukushima earthquake outside Japan, you realize that it actually affects the entire planet Earth. You can actually calculate how much the day has been shortened, about a microsecond, by the way, out of 24 hours. And you can actually calculate how many feet the Earth itself has been displaced by this massive shift of rock in the planet Earth. And so, yeah, we have to realize that earthquakes can actually change the orbit of the Earth as it goes around the sun. However, it's not going to create anything that we can feel or anything that we notice. These are microscopic changes that are measurable by instruments, and we can duplicate them in our computer programs. But it's not something that you can feel.
No, not at all. Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Yes, hi, Dr. Kaku. Hi. I'm an amateur astronomer and an atheist myself, and I have a great out-of-the-box question for you. And it's my question is on the intricacies of string theory as applied to our human brains and human consciousness. And my question is, according to string theory, since the nature and the vibration of each and every string describes what kind of particles of matter it is, or what particles of matter it manifests itself, in relation to consciousness and our brains, could it work in reverse to describe the mind, meaning that the intricate chemical and molecular composition of our human brains, because we are conscious, manifests a unique kind of strings that could exist independently of the brain in an energy dimension or energy universe, let's say, without invoking God, which is irrational and mythical, as well as heaven or hell? In other words, could that be a scientific explanation for not only near-death experiences, but what might happen after one actually does die, in that the fields, energy field of the strings of the parts of the trillions of parts of the brains are something that exists in an energy dimension or an energy universe?
Hmm.
Well, you ask a mouthful, but let me try to break it down one by one. First of all, we physicists believe that we can't yet prove that every particle is nothing but a note on a vibrating string. So think of a rubber band. An electron would be a rubber band vibrating one frequency. If you twang the rubber band, it turns into a neutrino or turns into a quark. And so all the notes of a string correspond to the subatomic particles. So the harmonies of the string correspond to the laws of physics. Chemistry would be the melodies you can play on strings that interact with each other. The universe would be a symphony of strings. And then the mind of God that Einstein eloquently wrote about for the last 30 years of his life, the mind of God would be cosmic music resonating through 11-dimensional hyperspace. Now, you ask a different question. You ask whether or not the string picture could then explain the human mind. Well, remember that we're talking about subatomic particles. When you talk about atoms and molecules, then ordinary chemistry is perfectly fine. You don't have to resort to string theory to explain consciousness, the mind, spirit, and stuff like that. The string theory is nice because it explains the diversity of subatomic particles. But when you talk about the brain, you're talking about atoms, you're talking about molecules, you're talking about concentrations of large-scale structures that then create neurons and electrical circuits and consciousness and the brain. So you don't need string theory to explain consciousness. That's overkill.
As you look at all the various aspects that you've handled in your career, Michio, is there still one for you that's baffling?
Well, yeah, it's why time goes forward and not backwards. If you play a billiard game, you could run the videotape backwards, and the billiard game is, well, more or less the same, except, of course, when you start the billiard game. Every interaction is time reversible, and yet our universe seems to go in a preferred direction. And so one of the embarrassing questions of physics is, why does time go forward and not backward, like Benjamin Button? Why don't we get younger with age, and why don't we jump into our mother's womb rather than dying? These are cosmic questions that are still bothering us. Another question is the end of the universe. We physicists, of course, have many theories about the beginning of the universe, but now we're beginning to contemplate how the universe itself may die billions of years from now, that our universe is accelerating. The Nobel Prize was given just a few months ago to three astronomers who showed that the universe is not slowing down as we once thought. It's actually speeding up. It's getting bigger and bigger and accelerating, in which case we could end up in a big freeze. Now, my point of view is that the big freeze, even though it sounds very depressing, we're all going to freeze to death really years from now. At that point, we may decide to leave the universe. This, of course, is still controversial. But, you know, billions, trillions of years from now, we'll be quite advanced. We'll be able to manipulate space and time, perhaps at will, in which case perhaps we'll create a lifeboat and leave our dying universe to go to a younger universe and start all over again. Or, for that matter, maybe aliens from another universe that's dying have left their universe and come into our universe because our universe is younger and warmer. You can't rule that out.
Do you think we'll be around a billion years from now, Michio?
Well, not in our present form. I think that, we may democratically decide to change form, centuries, millennia from now. We may decide to become immortal. We may unlock the secret of immortality, either by using artificial intelligence or using genetics. And as a consequence, that's a game changer. It changes our whole understanding of our place in the universe once we begin to tinker with expanding the human lifespan. And already we've been able to find many of the genes which seem to control the lifespan of animals. And we can double the lifespan of most animals simply by starving them, by limiting the caloric intake. If you eat 30% less, you live 30% longer. That's been verified in every single animal, all the way up to primates, except humans, because we live too long and we're too fussy and we have a messy diet. But it does mean that we're unlocking now the genetics that make that possible. Some of the genes that allow you to double the lifespan of animals has been isolated now. And so, and also, we're 98.5% genetically equivalent to a chimpanzee. Only a handful of genes separate us from a chimpanzee, but we live twice as long. And so the genes which doubled our lifespan are among the genes which we are now sequencing. So it's conceivable that we may unlock the secret of aging in the coming decades. Can't be ruled out at all.
No, it can't. First-time caller Mark in Manchester, Connecticut. Hey, Mark, thanks for calling.
Good evening. It's an honor to speak, to be on your show, George, and to speak with Michio.
Thank you.
I have a personal thing that I've thought of. What if you die in this life and you haven't yet learned what you needed to learn in this life? What's to say you're not sent to another universe or another dimension or another Earth where everything is the same except you're still alive?
Well, you know, if you believe in the concept of reincarnation, you can simply say that you keep coming back until you reach perfection, simple as that. But I guess there could be other dimensions that exist like us, can't there?
Yeah, it's possible that in an alternate universe where one quantum event has shifted our universe and separated us, that a loved one didn't have to die. Some of our loved ones could still be alive in another universe. That's well within the laws of physics. This is called the many worlds theory, which means that Elvis Presley could still be alive in another parallel universe. That quantum events in our universe separate us from a universe where Elvis Presley is still alive, and some of our loved ones didn't have to die. Now, of course, communicating with these other parallel universes is extremely difficult. However, the fact that these other universes have peeled off from our universe is based on a theory of quantum mechanics called many worlds. It's a theory that we actually teach at the graduate level at our leading universities. And it does mean that the universe is constantly splitting apart. Universe is splitting from our universe. So there are carbon copies of you, except there's a little twist. There's something different. You married somebody different. You went to a different university, chose a different occupation. And this is well within the laws of physics. In fact, it's called the many worlds theory.
Let's go to Al in Louisiana. Hey, Al, thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning there, guys. I have a couple of quick questions. Sure. First one, Michio, is about two or three years ago on your Science Fantastic radio show, you were talking about some astronomical object or UFO in effect that you described as looking like a starfish with a tail. I was wondering what whatever happened with that, what it turned out to be. And also, I was wondering, could you talk a little bit about the latest satellite data on the cosmic background radiation and if it supports the idea of different inflationary regions beyond 15 billion light years ago that could be totally different as far as cosmic structure? Thanks.
Well, you ask a mouthful of questions, but let me try to tackle them. It turns out that we have a satellite in outer space called the WMAP. It's given us stunning baby pictures of the infant universe when it was only 300,000 years old. We have baby pictures of the Big Bang. You can actually see the cosmic explosion that took place 13.7 billion years ago. And so we have a snapshot of the ancient universe when it was only a baby, 300,000 years of age. And the data from this baby universe seems to indicate that the so-called inflationary universe theory is correct, meaning that the universe could have a second bang or a third bang. And the Big Bang is now a quantum event. And in quantum mechanics, there's a probability that even strange things can happen. And so there's a probability that there could be a second bang or a third bang, which means that universes could be created constantly. And so this is coming from the satellite data. It's irrefutable that the data seems to indicate that the inflationary theory is correct. Of course, we need more data to vindicate it. But so far, the inflationary picture fits all the numbers. And second of all, we do have anomalies in outer space that are quite strange, like starfish configuration.
Right.
We think that some of them could be explained as comets, as meteors, as exploding asteroids which collide. These are very rare events, but, you know, there's so many asteroids out there, and space is so big that sooner or later you're going to find asteroids that collide, you're going to find asteroids that blow up, and they will give you these strange starfish, strange geometric configurations in outer space. So we're beginning to realize that the universe is a lot stranger than we originally thought.
We've got a Skype caller in Ohio. It's Brian's turn. Go ahead, Bri.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm nervous, so I'm sorry if I...
That's all right. Don't worry about that.
I idolize both of you.
You're cool.
Anyway, I'm sorry, Doc, but this question might be trivial to you. I was wondering, since I do a lot of meditation and experience a lot of trance-like states, and I can hit what I would call a quick trance, and the feeling is very, very physical, and I was wondering what your take on that sort of thing is. I believe it might perhaps be some biochemistry in your brain, but I also feel like if I'm walking around and I'm doing something that requires a little concentration, I can trigger what feels like a wave going through my entire body. And what would you think the effects of something like that could do in some sort of in physics?
Well, you know, physicists have actually analyzed yogis who perform these incredible feats on camera, like being buried alive and being able to stop their heart. And so scientists have actually put these people to the test to find out exactly how you do stop your heart and how you could be buried alive and still survive. And they find some very interesting things. They find that these yogis can actually control their oxygen intake, reduce their metabolism to near fatal, to levels that are so low that you should die, but they still can live in this suspended state. And that's one reason why they can be buried alive. When you're buried alive, you put a pocket around your face, so there is a pocket of air when you are buried. But even then, you're consuming an extremely low level of oxygen because they can lower their metabolism rate down to the point which would kill an ordinary person. And then as far as stopping the heart, they can actually make their heart fibrillate. They don't actually stop the heart and therefore have no pulse and therefore die. They can temporarily induce fibrillation. And so things that were once considered impossible, we now realize are in fact medically possible when you put these people to the test. And it's because of meditation. It's because they've been able to access a state of consciousness of the brain that most of us have difficulty accessing. And as a consequence, it can control bodily functions and allow them to perform feats that were once considered to be impossible.
Michio, we're almost out of time. Name of your book, Physics of the Future. Where can you get it? I assume it's all over the place.
That's right. Also, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org, and I tour the country. So maybe I'll be coming to your city, signing your copy of Physics of the Future, which, as I said, is now a New York Times bestseller.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Dr. Michio Kaku, this is a special 2-2 program tonight. Up next, we're going to be talking with Grant Cameron about his latest work, U.S. Presidents and the UFOs, The Untold Story. So stick around for that on Coast to Coast AM. And again, Michio Kaku's book, latest, it's a great one, Physics of the Future. I shall be right back.